So we're going to get started. We're jumping in. We're also live streaming for those who are wives, children, friends, or at home and weren't able to make it for one reason or another. It can also be viewed later on. But it's a pleasure to be here. Welcome to our three-week Space Medrash. This is a program that we planned and hoped never needed to happen. The goal of a three-week Space Medrash is to become obsolete, because in 3 weeks, really, we want to be obsolete. We don't want to spend time commemorating the destruction of the temple. But we're so happy that now that we're here, that we've got a group of people who are excited and interested in learning, who are davening Mincha early, davening Maariv late, to make it happen. Thank you very much to Rabbi Bressler and Goldstein for putting it all together. I just get to show up, and as a Kohen, I guess I get to go first. But next week, Rabbi Goldstein will be up, and then Aharon Chaviv. In ways more than one, we have Rabbi Bressler ending us off. And so, just to give a tiny bit of context in the little time we have of what we're doing, why we're here, particularly in this particular shiur topic, Rabbi Goldstein and I were discussing what shiur would be interesting to give, and Rabbi Goldstein, very foolishly, if I may, not Khalil, said that he wants to talk about Bar Kamsa because he thinks that Bar Kamsa was a bad guy. And I don't want to spoil any more of his approach, but that's what he's going to share next week. And I told him, I'm not so convinced. I'm not so sure that Kamsa is in fact a bad guy. So officially our title is whatever on the flyer. I think Bar Kamsa, Misunderstanding, Sinat Chinam. But if you'll notice on the bottom, I put sort of the title that came to mind at the time was Bar Kamsa a perpetrator or a product? And what in the world that we're talking about, that we'll see as we go. So let's jump in without any further ado. As we're talking about the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, it's a very sad topic, and the Gemara talks about it in more than one place, and actually gives more than one reason, surprisingly. If at any point in time I say something without translating, then please stop me and let me know. If I'm unclear, please feel free to raise your hand or just start yelling at me. That's what my friends tend to do. But with that, let's jump in source one, the Gemara in Masechet Yoma. We were zocher to learn this together in the Kola last year, and the Gemara tells us that why was the second Beis HaMikdash destroyed? The first one was because of the big three, then you know, Shvikas Damim, Gilai Raos, and Avodah Zarah, but Avodah Mikdash Sheni, the second temple, why was it destroyed? Shehayu oskim b'Torah v'mitzvos u'gmilas chasadim. They were doing all the good things. They weren't worshiping idols, and they weren't having an appropriate relationship. So why was it destroyed? Mipnei macharav, mipnei shehaisa bo sinas chinam. Because there was a baseless hatred at play. This is likely a Gemara that we've heard in one way, shape, or form over time. And so even though sinas chinam is not one of the big three, not one of the worst things that you can do, not one of the things that are yahareg val yaver, that you should die rather than violate. The Gemara tells us, "Lamdecha sheshakula sinas chinam keneged shalosh averos." It really, in some ways, is equivalent to the three. So that's reason number one. That's our first answer. Why was the temple destroyed? Someone asks you at 3 a.m. They wake you up and say, "Why was the temple destroyed?" You'll tell them, "Sinas chinam. I learned the Gemara in Yoma. Daf Yomi did this recently, so it's clearly on my mind." Perfect. Except if we're doing Daf Yomi and we're a little patient, we keep going, we make it through Baba Kama, we make it through part of Baba Metzia, we'll hit it Baba Metzia on Daf Lamed Amud Beis, where it tells us that this Pasuk Asher Ya'asun, and based off of the explanation of Rabbi Yochanan, Lo Chava Yishalayim Ela Al Shedanu Ba Dine Torah. Why was the temple destroyed? Not because of Sinas Chinam, because they judged court cases on the basis of law, a basis on the Torah. That's the reason to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, because their court cases were based off the Torah. And then the Gemara says, they give the same look that I just got. What do you mean that's a problem? That's so bad? Would it be better that their judges be based off of some arbitrary thought process? No. Ema shehemidu dinehem al din Torah velo avdu alifnim mishor tzedit. No, they stuck to the letter of the law, and they didn't go above and beyond the law. They weren't willing to supersede whatever the base text said and be even better. So that's answer number two, that they were just judging based on the Torah and not going above and beyond. And now we get to answer number three. And this one you'll notice has lines because we're going to be jumping to it back and forth. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, what does this line mean? Asher adam mefache tamen umakshe libo yipol bara. What is this line from Mishlei telling us? It's talking about Kamsa ubar Kamsa charv Yerushalayim. Why was Yerushalayim destroyed? Because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Now we have a third answer, that not only was it Sinas Chinam, not only was it that they judged their court cases not by the letter of the law instead of going above and beyond, but based on Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Now the first one made a lot of sense to us, The second one, okay, we can hear once with a little bit of explanation, but Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, this is two guys, seemingly. Rashi says that right there. Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Kach Shem Shnei Yehudim. It's just two Jewish guys. So what's the issue here? Why is that destroying the Yerushalayim? And so in order to understand that, we're going to have to look at the continuation. But I'll give you a sneak preview. Of these three answers, really, all of them are the reason for the destruction. All three of them are actually one reason in and of the same, but different facets, different sides of the equation. That's what we're going to explore this evening, how each and every one of these, sinat chinam, and judging, not going above and beyond, but just the base letter of the law, and kamsa and bar kamsa are all going to be the reason why the temple was destroyed. And so let's continue in the Gemara. Let's see this story about Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Starting at line number 4, Dehau Gavra. There was this guy, Derachve Kamsa. His friend, his best friend, was a guy named Kamsa. Ubal Devave Bar Kamsa. And his enemy, his arch nemesis, if you will, was a guy named Bar Kamsa. Very inconvenient that they were so similarly named, and we'll see why in a moment. And this guy's making a suda. He's making a party. And so our host, who remains nameless, he's making a party, and Amar Le Lashame, he says to his servant, Zil Isi Le Kamsa, invite my friend Kamsa. I want to have him over at my party. Also Isi Le Bar Kamsa. And the servant messed up. The servant wasn't paying attention. Maybe it was bad reception, and he didn't hear him properly. And he invites not Kamsa the friend, but the enemy Bar Kamsa. Also Ashkake Dehava Yasiv. And so the party comes, and the host sees that this his enemy Bar Kamsa is sitting there. Amrle Mikhti Hau Gavra Bal Devaved Tahau Gavrahu, my boy's haka kumpuk. What are you doing here? Why are you at my party? I don't like you. We're enemies. Get out. Line 8, Amrle Hol Vasa Shavkan Via Vinalka Dame Madachina Vashasina. I'm here, says Bar Kamsa. I'm at the party. Please don't make me leave. I'll pay for my plate. It doesn't have to cause you any harm. I'm not going to talk to you. I'm not going to bother you. I'm just going to be here. And what does the host say? Amar Le at the end of the line? Lo. No, you're not allowed to stay at my party. Line 9. Amar Le. Yavino Laka Dame Palga Desu Dasich. I'll pay for half of your party. It's going to cost you half of what you were expecting. Just let me stay at the party. It'd be so embarrassing for me to leave. Amar Le. Lo. Again, the host says to Bar Kamsa, you're not allowed to go. You're not allowed to stay. You must leave. I'll pay for the entire party. You won't have to spend a dime. Just let me stick around. And he grabs him and literally throws him out of the party. In line 12 we see, Amar, and now we get a personal narrative. This is what Bar Kamsa is seemingly thinking. He says, well, there are a bunch of rabbis there, a bunch of holy people. And they must have seen this happen, and they didn't stop it. They must have been okay with it. Ezel ikubuhu kurtza beimacha. I'm going to go talk to kurtza beimacha. I'm going to go talk to Rome, effectively. And this is during the time of the Second Temple, toward the end of the Second Temple. And this is when Rome was really running the show and causing a lot of tsaras for the Jewish people. And so in 9:13, we see what happens in his conversation with Rome. Azel amar le kesar mardu bar Yehuda. The Jewish people are rebelling against Rome. Amrle me, Amrle, why do you get that idea that they're rebelling? And Bar Kamsa tells Rome, I'll prove it to you. Amrle, shadal hu korbana chazis I mekarvenle. Send them an offering, send them an animal to bring in the temple and see. Do they in fact bring it on the Mizbeach? Do they offer this korban? Azal shadar biyade eglat lisa. And they send this eglat lisa, this really, really juicy, really, really, really fat egel, this fat cow. And we see this come up in numerous places. Tosfos points out in this Gemara that's a way that they would celebrate. On Shabbos, you'd often use an eglat lisa. When Rav Yosef wants to celebrate Torah on Shavuos, he wants an eglat lisa. This is sort of the carbon. Rome is sending, not like a little scrappy carbon, they're sending a chashuv, expensive carbon. But what does Bar Kamsa do? Seemingly, he's a little bit conniving, as far as we can tell. Bahade de Ka'asi, and when they sent it, Shata be Muma beniv sasaim, and he gives it a mum. He gives it a blemish, and what does he do? He puts it on the lip. Seemingly, the upper lip, says Rashi, Safa hal Yona, v'amrila bedukin shabayin, and maybe it was a messed up eye instead of the lip. Dilididon, as far as we're concerned, Hava Muma, as far as the Jewish people are concerned, that is a moment, it's a blemish that you're not allowed to offer in the temple, except Lidido, according to the Romans, that's not a blemish. You know, a little thing on the lip, who cares? And the Maharal has a lot to say about the differences between the Jewish people and the non-Jewish people and the Romans at the time, how they spoke, what they looked at, but that's not our topic for now. Savar Rabbanu Lekrove Mishum Shalom Malchus, and the rabbis are wondering, what do we do? We've got a blemished carbon. Do we offer it? Do we not offer it? Line 19, we say, Amar Lehu Rav Zakaria ben Avkula. So Zakaria ben Avkula says, he throws in his opinion into the mix and says, Yomru Bale Mumin Kraven Legabe Mizbeach. We can't offer a blemished animal because people are going to think you're allowed to offer blemished animals on the Mizbeach, and that's not going to be okay. That would ruin our Jewish practices. And Savar Lemetile, Delo Lezo Velema. So, okay, if we're not allowed to offer it, maybe we got to kill Bar Kamsa, because if Bar Kamsa here knows we don't offer it, he's going to go to Rome and tell on us. And so really, in some ways, maybe we should put him to death. And, you know, this past Shabbos morning, we talked about the din of a Rodef. I don't know if anyone, I think we had one person in the room, but effectively, Bar Kamsa could lead to our demise, he could lead to our death if he tells on us to Rome that we didn't offer their carbon, their cow, so maybe we should kill him. And again, Rav Zakaria ben Avkula speaks up and says, no, you can't do that, Yomru, Matil Mum B'Kachim Miharei, that if somebody puts a blemish into Kachim, then they're going to be killed. People are going to get the wrong idea, that would be inappropriate. Ordinarily, if you put a blemish into a carbon, then there are ramifications for it, but not death. This would be a special circumstance. We don't want people to misunderstand. So finally, our Gemara concludes. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan, again, in some ways, the harbinger of destruction, as far as I can tell, tells us that why was the temple destroyed? Now, not because of Bar Kamsa and Kamsa, but because of Anvenuso, which is a hard word to translate. We'll try to understand it. The Anvenuso shall Rabbi Zakaria ben Avkulos, Hechriv es Batenu, Vesarf es Hechalenu, Glisanu Meyotzenu, that because of Zakaria ben Avkulos and his Anvenuso, then our house was destroyed, and the Heikal, the inner sanctuary, was burnt up, and we were kicked out of our land. Thus ends the Gemara on page 1. It's a very sad story. It's a very sad Gemara. But it leaves us with a few questions, a little bit unclear. We saw the Gemara, it's a sad story, it's an unfortunate story about someone getting mistakenly invited to a party and then kicked out of the party. And then because of the experience at that party, he goes to Rome and eventually leads to the destruction of the Second Temple. And there are numerous commentaries that discuss it. Today we're going to look at the commentaries of predominantly two people, but really three people who explain it. One of them is the Maharsha, which is Rabbi Shmuel Eliezer ben Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi Edels, who was a commentary in the end of the 1500s in Poland. The Maharal of Prague, who we've likely heard of, who talks about this both in his commentary on the Gemara and in his Sefer Netzach Yisrael, which is all about Galus and Geula, exile and redemption. And then the Ben Yehoyada, a good Sephardi rabbi from Baghdad, Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, the Ben Ishchai, who lived much sooner. He lived in the 1800s. And all of them together are going to help us get a better picture of this story, because it seems there are a lot of questions we could ask. Do we want to throw out a few questions? Anything that jumped out at us as we were reading?
Well, Rabbi Yochanan wanted to say both number 2 and number 3.
Ah.
And number 2 was, they did not go to the Mishra's Tehri.
Right.
And obviously number 3 is because they could have made a little exception, and therefore he seems to be saying the same thing, basically.
Okay, fine. So, at the very beginning of our Gemara, we suggested that there are three answers, but really there's one answer. And Alan's pointing out that Rabbi Yochanan is speaking in sources 2 and sources 3. I'll tell you a secret, I didn't copy the whole thing. But depending on how you read the Gemara, Rabbi Yochanan is present in Yoma as well. Maybe he's talking, maybe Rabbi Yose is talking. That's a little bit unclear, but it's very possible that Rabbi Yochanan's teaching all three of these, which would make sense that he's saying the same thing, but saying the same thing in three different ways.
Do you disagree with what the rabbi told them? Rabbi
Zakaria ben
Avkulos.
So it would seem that Rabbi Zakaria ben Avkulos, this rabbi at the end of our story who prevented them from doing anything with the calf, which led to the eventual destruction, it would seem that he is acting by the letter of law and not sort of being willing to flex, not being willing to do things maybe above the letter of the law or with an understanding of the circumstance going on. And so Alan wants to point out that there's clearly a connection between the two. And that's something we're going to think about, we're going to put in the back of our minds and address in a few minutes. Any other insights, any other questions we want to address before we jump in?
Was this mum specifically a mum kavua, or was it a mum over?
So if we have someone who's a big Talmud Chacham and learned Daf Yomi, he knows all about the different kinds of blemishes you can have in an animal. So was this a permanent blemish or one that might go away after some time? I'll tell you. I haven't done Daf Yomi. The Kol has spent time learning Kachim, but not learning Zvachim to know all the details. And the only thing that I can say with certainty is that the Gemara testifies that this is a blemish for the purposes of us, which would be problematic. This is considered a blemish that would invalidate the offering. As far as Romans were concerned, it was not. And so the specific of what made that a blemish, we could look into, but we're not going to look into right now. Very helpful ha'ara. Now, you'll notice in the Kollel, everyone has their strengths. Rabbi Goldstein, Sunni, is deeply learned and a strong Talmud of Rabbi Lichtenstein. Rabbi Yossi Katz, his excitement and his energy is applied to Torah, and he learns tons and tons of things and knows everything there is to know. Rabbi Brand is crazy talented. Rabbi Kraft is now a Dayan. Ari Zucker knows how to make source sheets. That's where it goes. And so you'll notice this is actually stolen, an idea taken from Rabbi Yaakov Trump, who was an alumnus of our Kollel. You'll notice that the Maharsha, when I put him in our little box with the bio, is in one font, the Maharal is in one font, and the Ben Yoyada is in a different font. And so for the subsequent sources, I haven't told you who's speaking, unless it was coming from a Gemara, specifically because I told you which font it is. And if it's in the font of Calibri, for those who are holding, I guess you could say, that's coming from the Maharal. If it's in the Hadassah Friedlander font, which is also the Art Scroll font, then it's the Maharsha, and so on and so forth. And so I'll, God willing, point it out, but you know, you have our little reference key box at the top of page 2. And so this first source is in the Maharal and Netzach Yisrael. A lot of the ideas are coming from the Maharal and his Netzach Yisrael, but there's plenty from the Maharsha and the Ben Yoyada as well. And so the Maharsha asks us to pay attention to the language. Asks us to pay attention to the language of Kamsa. What does Kamsa mean? Kasher tidaktik b'loshon Kamsa, ki Hashem hazeh mor al chiluk. The name Kamsa means separation, means distance. Shekore Kamsa al shem hachiluk v'apirud. You're called Kamsa because of the separation, because of the distance. Ki zehu loshon Kamitza. That's like the language of Kamitza. For our people who are well-learned and know about the temple service, when you take a specific amount from from the flower offering and you set it aside, effectively you make part of the offering exclusive and set it apart from the rest, and the rest gets left out of the special offering, and only this small amount, a handful of your big flower offering, the kemitza, is brought as an offering to the temple. It gets to be holy. Lufikach hanifrad v'hanechalach me'akol nikra kamsa. And so, if something is separate, if something is exclusive, then it's called kamsa. Now, what does kamsa mean? Kamsa means exclusive. So, if kamsa means exclusive, then this is a story about exclusion. And that's, I think, is illustrated in this passage, parsha. If we can go back, you know, amongst Hungarians, I believe, they used to learn Parsha from Wednesday to Tuesday, not Sunday to Shabbos. And so even though we read Parshas Balak this past Shabbos morning, we're still in Parshas Balak according to Hungarians. We're also students of Rebbe Soloveitchik. He used to give a shiur on, I believe, Tuesday nights in New York. He used to live in Boston and fly in and give shiur on Tuesday and Wednesday and then fly out, I think, Thursday morning, whatever it was. But he used to give a shiur on Tuesday night, and he would give shiur in this past week's Parsha. And so unless you were like really well prepared, really organized, you could go to the shiur, you could take notes, but you can never repeat it to someone else because no one cares what happened last week. It's Tuesday night. By the time it's done, it's already Wednesday, and then everyone's thinking about next week. So even though many people in the world are thinking about Matos Masei, I think about Pinchas. Thank you. That's why we have a shul rabbi here. I think about Pinchas. We're still thinking about Parshas Balak for just a few minutes because Balak bothers me. And the Parsha bothers me because we learn about Bilam. And Bilam is supposed to be this prophet of the nations. The Sifri in Devarim 3:5-7 tells us that the nations of the world wanted to have a prophet, and the Jewish people have a prophet. Who is the prophet of the Jewish people? Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe, whose face shined. Moshe, who's got these sterling midos, who was the paragon of humility, of chesed. This is the person leading the Jewish people. This is our prophet. And the nations of the world say, we want a prophet. Give us a prophet. And so God says, sure, you guys can have Bilam. Now who's Bilam? The guy is chasing after money. Apparently he's chasing after not just women, but donkeys. The guy's a very, very bad guy. An egomaniac. And so if I'm a member of the nations of the world, if I'm not Jewish, and God's like, don't worry, you guys get a prophet also. They got Moshe Rabbeinu, and you guys got Bilam. I'm going to say no fair. I'm going to say Amazon gives me free returns. How come I don't get a return on this? It's not cool. This is a bad trade-off. He's a terrible counterpart. Bilam seemingly is not the prophet I'm looking for. I'm looking for a Moshe Rabbeinu-esque individual to be the prophet of the nations. So, no fair. But I think if we really appreciate where Bilam comes from and where Moshe comes from, it makes sense. Because let's look at the Gemara in Arachin on 17a. Malcolm Rosenbaum pointed this out to me 2 years ago, actually. We say, Zeh dor darshav merakshei panecha Yaakov Sela. We quote a pasuk from Eshechayil. And we say, Pligi bar Rabbi Yehuda nisiya v'rabbanan. We got a machlokus between Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who wrote down the Mishnah, and the rest of the rabbis. Chad Amar, one of them says, Dor lifi parnas, v'chad Amar, parnas lifi doro. That one is telling us that based on the leader, that's what the generation will look like. If you have a righteous leader, you'll have a righteous generation. And the other opinion is telling us that if you have a righteous generation, you'll have a righteous leader. And so what do we see? Let's think about Moshe Rabbeinu. Where did Moshe Rabbeinu come from? What's the name Moshe is not the name his parents gave him. It's the name that Bas Paro, the daughter of Paro, who saved his life, that saved the life of a poor, flailing baby Jew. She saved his life and she called him Moshe. That was his name forever, that he's the product of someone going above and beyond and saving somebody. Moshe was brought in by Yisro. Moshe was watched over by Miriam. Moshe was consistently saved. Moshe was consistently shown humility. And so Moshe becomes an amplification of the environment in which he grew up. Moshe becomes the prime example of the Jewish community, an example of humility, an example of kindness. Where did Bilam grow up? Bilam grew up amongst people like Balak, who were looking to curse the Jewish people. Bilam grew up against people who were selfish, people who were chasing after money and carnal desires. And so what did you expect? Bilam is just going to be an amplification of his environment, of his generation. And so you can't be upset if you're amongst the nations of the world that you got a Bilam. You made Bilam. And we can be pretty proud of ourselves when we look at Moshe Rabbeinu. We made Moshe. Moshe was a product of our community. And so just like, you know, you have hometown heroes, you have the rabbis who grew up here and become, you know, big prominent leaders of the community, and people get extra nachas knowing that they're a local Chicagoan. We're not going to mention any names. We don't embarrass anyone who may or may not be the only person who managed to get into Israel, even though there are like these massive blockades. But okay, fine. When we make someone, when we build somebody, we can get nachas because any one of our leaders is a result of our community. And so if that's the case with Moshe and Bilam, I wonder if it's maybe the same thing when it comes to our story. Let's look at... Look, for you guys, I think it's still on page 2. But let's look at we're going to break down the Gemara. And we say, Kamsa Bar Kamsa Chav Yerushalayim. That because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, the Yerushalayim was destroyed. And we're going to answer and understand how Sin Achinam and Bar Kamsa are really similar, really fit together. But the host and Bar Kamsa really differentiate because of this baseless hatred. And it's appropriate that we had the host and we had this guy Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. The second temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred. And it was for people, it was for an environment, a generation, a community that was separate, that was exclusive. And that's why we say that because of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa, Yerushalayim was destroyed.
Kamsa isn't part of the story at all.
So you can argue, and we're going to elaborate on that in just a little bit more, but you could argue, why is this guy Kamsa getting called out? He was at home. He wasn't invited to the party at all. And so Rabbi Rosenbaum will tell you that it's a function of the community. Forget what Rabbi Rosenbaum will tell you, because he disagreed with me, but I'm forgetting how. I'm really thinking about sort of our Mahalach. But I think what we could say is that Kamsa is representative, indicative of the community that took place. We're going to elaborate that in a little bit more in just a moment. But we say, ki in safek, ki shmam shal elu anashim hayanikra al inyan shalahem, that their names are based off of their personalities, who they were. And so when we call someone Kamsa or Bar Kamsa, we might not be talking just about personalities. It's not like calling somebody David or Jamie or Sarah. We're talking about a personality of Kamsa, a personality of Bar Kamsa, personality of exclusion and of Bar Kamsa. We'll see what that means in just a moment. Because if we're saying that there was Kamsonus, there was exclusion in this generation, we're saying there was Sinas Chinam, they're saying there's baseless hatred. And we look at the Maharsha, who's explaining this Gemara, V'amar da'azal aisile Bar Kamsa, and so he ends up inviting Bar Kamsa, and Maharsha wants to know, who is this person Bar Kamsa? Because I'm seeing a similarity here. I'm seeing Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Those names sound pretty familiar, sound pretty similar. What does Bar mean? Son.
A son
or product of. Thank you. And so, you know, we have a bat mitzvah and we have a bar mitzvah. Now, why is it called a bar mitzvah, not a ben mitzvah? Don't have a good answer to that. But bar is just the Aramaic term for son of. And so the Maharsha says, very logically, Efshar Shahaya Ze Abu Bruno. Maybe it's possible that we had this guy named Kamsa, who was a friend of the host, and Bar Kamsa, who's not a friend of the host. Maybe Bar Kamsa was a difficult kid, and now he's grown up, but the host still doesn't like him. When you live in Chicago, and you grow up in Chicago, and you buy a house here when you first get married, then all the people you know are your parents' friends. But Baruch Hashem and Kings, we've got a young community, and there are plenty of people here who aren't just your parents' friends. You've got friends of your own you can make. But Maharshaz is suggesting that Bar Kamsa is very simply the son of this guy named Kamsa. But the Ian Yaakov says that not a chance, doesn't make any sense. It's not on our page. But he says, no, that would be Kamsa Ubrei, if we're going to get technical. It would be Kamsa and his son, not Kamsa and this person Bar Kamsa. It must be something else. So let's suggest an alternative shot. What is the significance of calling somebody Bar Kamsa? Because we can see that Kamsa is maybe this culture, this personality of exclusion. This is in our next source, in the blue. V'yesh lecha lahav lihis bonin. Ma asa Kamsa? What did Kamsa do? What did this guy do? He stayed at home. Uma pashu uma kalatu sha'amar al yidei Kamsa charav Yishalayim. Why is he getting blamed? He didn't even go to the party. Aval yesh lecha lada'as. Because in his generation there was baseless hatred and there was argument and there was fighting. And how does it work? How do you have a culture of fighting? How do you have a culture of baseless hatred? Everyone has to talk to someone, but if I invite somebody over and we talk badly about somebody else, now even though my friend wasn't not inviting this guy to the party, but by being part of an exclusive environment, this Kamsa personality is really contributing to a community and an environment of exclusion. And so the guy's friend named Kamsa was really contributing to this negative environment. And jump down to the blue bold again. And so someone who's friendly with an exclusive personality, and who's really just connecting for an exclusive purpose, you get to be on the inside. So you're going to be called Kamsa, and the person who's outside of it, when we say Bar Kamsa might be son of Machlokas, it might be product of Machlokas, but what does Bar mean? We have Mishnayot and we have a Braita. A Braita is a teaching from the times of the Tanaim, just like a Mishnah, except a Braita is a teaching that is Bar, that is outside. Someone who is Bar Kamsa is outside of exclusion. They are the one who is being excluded. When you have an exclusive environment, but you're invited to the exclusive environment, when you're part of the clique, it's kind of geschmack. It's kind of fun. You feel good about yourself. You got invited to the party. But then you have a guy named Bar Kamsa who never gets invited to the party. He's always the one left out, because you feeling good is only a function of you getting invited, because he's not invited. If everyone got invited to the party, it wouldn't be exclusive anymore. You need someone to, in the words of Syndrome, if everyone's super, no one is. If everyone's invited to the party, then no one's exclusive, no one's special. And so this guy of Bar Kamsa is outside the party, and the name Kamsa is an indication of a person who is really enabling, who is allowing, who is contributing to an exclusive environment. Now we'll break for a story, because we've been analyzing a lot. Rabbi J.J. Schachter calls them brain breaks, but we got to pay attention nonetheless. When I was young, I was a lot younger. I remember being, it was one of the early years of my grown life. I must have been in college at the time, and it was a couple of weeks, maybe a week before Pesach. And I'm in West Orange, New Jersey, and I meet the cousins of one of the people I know. I'm talking to this guy. He's a few years older than I am, and he's a general, not a general, and he's a commander in the army. And so usually you meet a commander, the question you always ask is, what division are you in? What unit are you in? You're doing tanks, you're paratroopers, and you pretend like you know what division they're talking about and what they're doing. Oh, yeah, that sounds very good. I'm very impressive. I assume everyone's impressive. And so he tells me that he's not a paratrooper, he's not in the tanks, he's not in the infantry. He is a commander for Russian immigrants. Because Russian immigrants now are in a somewhat of a precarious situation. It's unclear if they're full-fledged Jews or not full-fledged Jews. And so there's a whole process to sort of ensure that they are Jewish. And they go to the mikvah. For guys, it's a little bit more complicated because they get a little bit of a prick also. We don't have to explain all of that. But in order to convert, even if you're just converting from as a stringency, Giur L'Chumra, as we call it, then you gotta make sure you know something. And so they teach them classes. And this guy says that he's the commander. They're in class all day, and he's the one who makes sure they show up and that they don't miss anything. And he teaches a class. So I said, what class are you teaching? And I'm like picturing in my mind, what are the most important things to teach someone who doesn't know that much about Judaism? What's the most important thing to teach these Russian immigrants? And he says, I teach them a whole class on Ben Adam L'Chaveiro, a whole class on our interactions between other people. And I was young at the time, and I wasn't so good at thinking on the spot, and so I kind of blurred out, why? Why would you do that? There are so many things to teach you. Shabbos, kashrus, there are so many things you could teach you. I teach you about kamitza. Maybe not kamitza. But why are you teaching them the laws of ben adam l'chaver? Like, that's not so important. And he says, I don't know. I mean, you look at the... Okay, not here. You look at the Ten Commandments. You look at the two tablets. One of them are, you know, laws between us and God. And one of them are laws between man and his fellow man. It seems pretty important to me. And, you know, that at the time, that wasn't really a sensitivity I had, but it really opened my eyes that, you know, a lot of times we might think about someone who's from. You know, colloquially, when we talk about someone who's from, it's usually three categories. Are we familiar with this? Somebody who's from, I think colloquially, maybe not. There aren't really hard sources to back this up, but, you know, someone who keeps Shabbos, someone who keeps kosher, someone who keeps family purity, taras mishpacha, that's considered from. You know, whether they get their suits checked for shotness or not, you know, we're not as discerning, but those three things, seemingly just for the continuation of our environment, for our community, those are the things we expect someone to do in order to be quote-unquote from. And we'll just point out, Revolbi doesn't like the terminology of from, but we don't need to get into that. And so, if those three things are the only thing we consider to be from, then there's a lot of things that don't seem to fit into that. That seems to be a focus on things between us and God, not necessarily things between us and our fellow man. So what if you have someone who keeps Shabbos, keeps kashrus, keeps family purity, but, you know, they're a bully, you know, they beat people up. What if, you know, if maybe they don't physically beat people up, but they financially beat people up, they've got terrible midos, they don't pay their workers on time, whatever the example is. Someone who is violating Ben Adam L'Chaver, do we still consider them to be from? Do we still consider them to be Torah observant? I think Bar Kamsa looked at a mission for Kedavot. I think Bar Kamsa was kicked out of a party, embarrassed in front of the whole community. He looked at a mission for Kedavot, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah Omer, in Avot 3:17, in Ein Torah, Ein Derech Eretz. If you don't have Torah, you can't possibly have Derech Eretz. But, in Ein Derech Eretz, if you don't have good midos, you don't act in a nice way, you don't treat your fellow man well, Ein Torah. You don't really have Torah. I don't care if you keep Shabbos, if you treat people poorly. And it's not just that, but there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin. There's a fascinating Gemara that as Nebuchadnezzar is destroying the temple, destroying the first temple, you know, he's all excited and he's feeling good about himself. And Nafka Baskala, and at Baskal, a heavenly voice rings out and says, Ama Katila Katalta, a nation that was dead, you've killed. Hekala Kalia Kalis, and a sanctuary that was already burnt, you've burnt. Kimka Tachina Tachinta, and flour that was already ground, or wheat that was ground, you've ground. Effectively, Nebuchadnezzar, in destroying the temple, you haven't really done anything. You haven't accomplished much. The temple's already dead. Yes, was the building still standing? For sure. But it doesn't mean much. As far as God was concerned, if the Jewish people aren't following the Torah, if the Jewish people are not living the Torah, then it's not really worth standing. It's not really, really, really there. I'll tell you another story that I heard from Rabbi Rosenbaum. It's with Rabbi Zev Cohen. I called him today just to confirm the story. This is the story. This you got to hear. Zev Cohen, early on when he was first a rabbi here, I had a shayla. He called up Rav Shimon Schwab. Rav Shimon Schwab, who wrote the Mayan Beis HaShoeva, one of a beautiful Parsha Sefer. Rav Schwab, who was one of the prime students of the Rav Hirsch dynasty and was the rabbi in Washington Heights, you know, right across the way for our YU students. Rav Schwab was one of the big rabbis of our generation. And so he gets a call from Rav Zev Cohen. Rav Zev Cohen's got a shayla. And he says that there's a situation where a woman's being asked to present books for a guy, from guy who's got an all-cash business. Can he give the books? Is it an issue of Mesirah, of turning another Jew into the authorities? And so Rav Schwab says, I don't understand. So again, over the phone, Rav Cohen says, there's a from guy with an all-cash business. Is it going to be a problem to give over the books? I don't understand. And so now Rav Cohen tells me, you know, his knees are shaking a little bit. You know, he thinks he's being clear. And so once again, he says, there's a from guy with an all-cash business. Can't you give over the books? And Rav Cohen said that even though he was in Chicago and Rav Schwab was in New York, he didn't need a phone to hear what he was about to say. Because Rav Schwab slammed his hand on the table and said, if it's an all-cash business, he's not from. If you're violating the law, if you're stealing from someone, if you're not reporting your taxes, if you're treating someone poorly, you're not from. Bar Kamsa looks at this party and says, if you kick someone out of a party and embarrass them in public, you're not from. What is the Beis HaMikdash standing for if not for this? ain derek eretz, ain Torah. And not just that, but he looks at the rabbis who are in attendance and says, you guys didn't do anything about it. You didn't stop me. You didn't stop them from kicking me out. And so if you didn't stop them from kicking me out, then what good are you? What are you accomplishing? And the Maharsha tells us that in the second source in the blue, Mashalo Michu b'pnei shelo haya biyadam limkos. Maybe the rabbis didn't stop them because they weren't able to stop them. They didn't have the ability to stand up and stop the host from kicking out Bar Kamsa. But the Maharal in Ner Mitzvah, in the next source, Maharal says, we don't have to read inside, the Maharal says that at the end of Ner Mitzvah, if the rabbi, what's the rabbi's job? The rabbi's job is to give musar. The rabbi's job is to give tokacha, to tell people that they're not doing the right thing, to make sure that people are keeping mitzvos, make sure that people are acting appropriately. And if they're acting inappropriately, the rabbi is expected, the rabbis of the generation are expected to get up and say something. When the rabbis get up and tell us there's too much talking in shul, they're supposed to do that. That's their job. That's literally why we pay them. If the rabbi's not standing up, then that's problematic. And so now in Gimel, in Shadabay, Muma, Benif Sasaim, so now Bar Kamsa comes up with an idea. Bar Kamsa says the rabbis are being passive, the rabbis are not doing what they're supposed to do, so I'm going to force the issue. And he sends an animal with a mum in the Nif Sasaim, with an injury in the mouth, with a blemish in the mouth. It's symbolic of a problem in the lips of the generation, a problem in the lips. Marsha says that people were speaking gossip, speaking Lashon Hara, but what if we said that Bar Kamsa was trying to tell the rabbis of the generation, you're not speaking up. You're not. It's almost like there's a cut in your lip. Rabbis, you need to speak up in this generation. And so in section Dalet, where we talk about the Anvenuso Shel Rabbi Zakai ben Avkulos, we see a Tosefta in Shabbos. Hillel Omrim, Magbiyin, Ashokan Atzamos Uklipin. On Shabbos, when you've got muksa items, you've got bones that are now useless, what are you supposed to do with them? You're supposed to take them off of the table. No, you don't take the individual pieces off. You take off the whole table. Just move the entire tablecloth. And in the bold, Amar Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi tells us, Anvenuso Shel Rabbi Zakaria ben Avkulos. Again, this Anvenuso of Zakaria ben Avkulos. Oh, sorry. Sorry. But what did Rabbi Zakaria ben Avkulos do? Sorry, in the second line. Lo haya noeg, lo kedivrei beis shammai, lo kedivrei beis hillel. He didn't do like either one. He didn't take the individual pieces off. He didn't remove the whole tablecloth. Ella, no tilu mashlik la'achar mita. Basically, he'd finish eating them. Instead of putting them down, where he would enter into having a question, where he'd have to paskin and decide either beis hillel or beis shammai. Instead, he finished eating and threw it behind his head. I'll deal with it later. I'll push it off. I'm not going to make a decision right now. And so again, Rabbi Yossi tells us, as a student of Rabbi Yochanan, Anvenuso Shel Rabbi Zakaria ben Avkulos, Sarfas Ahikal. And the Anvenuso, the inability to make a decision, that Rabbi Zakaria ben Avkulos is the reason why our temple was destroyed. Rabbi Zakaria ben Avkulos consistently is a person who's not interested and not willing to make a decision. And Bar Kamsa, is he a bad guy? Is he part of the reason why the destruction of the temple happened? Yes, there's not no question. But it seems that Bar Kamsa is a Bar Kamsa. He's a product of the generation that he grew up in. He was always on the outside. He was always excluded. And so what does he do? He tries to force the rabbis in a last-ditch effort to save Judaism. Yiddishkeit is falling apart. People are not treating each other well. There's a community of kamsanos, of exclusion. And it's not okay. And the Beis HaMikdash doesn't need to be standing. It's already been figuratively destroyed unless the rabbis do something, unless the rabbis stand up and give tokacha, give feedback, give a little guidance to the community if they're just willing to make a decision. And so he fabricates a shaila. He fabricates a situation where they have to do something, where they get a mum, and as far as a blemish in the mouth, and as far as the Romans are concerned, it's not a problem, but as far as we're concerned, as far as the rabbis are concerned, you can't offer it, and now they have to make a decision. And Bar Kamsa, we think of him as being a bad guy, what he did resulted in something bad, but maybe he was a tzaddik. Maybe he was willing to sacrifice his life, because one of the options was to offer the karbon, and one of them was to have them kill him. And Rabbi Zakaria ben Avkulos is not willing to make the decision. The Vilna Gaon says that he was the Av Beis Din, that he was the head of the whole court, and he spoke first. Basically, he paskin for everyone. He didn't let anyone else share an opinion. He says, we're not doing a thing. And so it all falls on him, because all Bar Kamsa was trying to do was to show the rabbis that you have to be active. You can't just sit back and watch things fall apart. Whenever our rabbis speak up and give us guidance and give us feedback, whether we want to hear it or not, that's what we pay them to do. It's what we want them to do. Rabbis' jobs are to put us on the path of Torah and on the path of justice. oftentimes, the theme of our Shiurim is Sinas Chinam. And the story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa is about misunderstanding Sinas Chinam. I can't speak for everyone else, but personally, I think for a long time, I thought of Sinas Chinam, of baseless hatred, as being something outside of myself. I'm a nice guy. I'm welcoming, I'm warm. Anyone who walks into our shul, I give a big hello to, sometimes a little bit late, but I always give a hello. And I'm not a Sonei Chinam. I'm not baselessly hating people. It's other people. It's that shul. It's the people over there. It's not me. In Chicago, we're nice. In town, I can't speak for that. But when you're out of town, people are nice. Sinas Chinam is something for someone else, not for me. But it's not just Bar Kamsa. It's not just Kamsa. If you live in a community, if you live in an environment, if you allow exclusion to foster, then that's why the base of money is destroyed. That's something that we can all create, because if either you're being excluded or you're facilitating exclusion to happen. Kamsa wasn't necessarily doing a bad thing. The host was doing a bad thing, but Kamsa still gets blamed, because if you facilitate exclusion, that's just as bad as making it happen yourself. And I'll just end with one thought about an organization called Yachad. On many, many summers, I was involved in Yachad 3 summers, and it mamash changed my life. The slogan of Yachad is because everyone belongs. Yachad is all about inclusion. And when we talk about Sinas Chinam and we translate it as exclusion, then I think that the only translation of Avas Chinam in our day is the word inclusion. And when you spend time on these summer programs with these Yachad members who have special needs and with high school students, and they mamash couldn't care less who you are. They couldn't care less if you have autism, if you don't have autism. People are making friends with people who go to school with them and people who are going to special needs schools. Yachad is not a perfect organization. Yachad doesn't do everything right. But the environment that's created in Yachad is an environment of Avas Chinam, of inclusion. And that's something that doesn't need to exclusively take place for high schools on a Shabbaton. That's something that we can all create. We can all foster an environment of inclusion. It's something that we do foster in the shul. That there are so many people who I've met over the past few weeks in Kiddush. And you ask them, you know, what brings you here? You know, why are you davening in Kins? And they'll always tell you that people are so warm and they're so welcoming here. And so this isn't necessarily Musar Shmuz for these people, even though I said that, you know, we think of it as other people, but it really genuinely might not be a problem in the shul, but it's something that we want to spread, we want to share with somebody else. And that's really the goal. That's how we fight Sinas Chinam. Kamsa and Bar Kamsa is a story of how every single individual can foster change, can foster growth, and can eventually be the reason for the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Thank you very, very much, and now we'll dive in.